Let's shift gears a little bit now and talk about substance abuse. Substance abuse, ladies and gentlemen, is an important topic for you on the exam. It's one of what we come to call the crossroads sections on the exam. Crossroads section, what we mean is you're going to see questions on this topic from, yes, the behavioral scientist, of course, but also from the physiologist, the pharmacologist, indeed the biochemist. This is a high yield area. A lot of different subjects converge to this particular application. Pay special attention to this area. If you're an international medical student, this is of particular interest to you because this may be content that you don't have any familiarity with. Spend some special attention studying substance abuse. Let's begin by talking about the basic underlying physiological issues. If you're not aware of it, you should be clear that there is a clear, specific pathway in the brain, which we've come to call the addiction pathway. This addiction pathway is a dopamine pathway. The pathway goes from the medial forebrain bundle through the nucleus accumbens and ends up in the ventral tegmental area. Medial forebrain bundle, nucleus accumbens to the ventral tegmental area. It's a dopamine pathway. Now, this is a pathway you want to have. In normal interaction, behavior in the world around you, we call this the positive reinforcement pathway. And what this pathway does is simple. You do a behavior, and this is the part of your brain that says, hey, that was a good thing to do. Let's remember that and do that again. What that means is if you're getting dopamine shots on this pathway by behavioral interaction with the world, this is helping to make your behavior more and more adaptive. You become more and more responsive to your environment and therefore more and more functional to the particular circumstances you find yourself in. What if your shots on the pathway are not from behavior interaction with the world, but artificially through taking in chemical substances? You see the problem? Now you're getting these positive reinforcement, this dopamine shot on the pathway, but not from behavior, but by artificial means. And so over time, your behavior now becomes less and less adaptive. If you're getting that feel good from drugs instead of that feel good from behavior, your capacity to see, appreciate, and deal with the world around you declines over time. Therefore, this adaptive positive reinforcement pathway becomes converted into the maladaptive addiction pathway. This addiction pathway is activated for all substances that have addicting qualities. Certainly for anything with physical addiction, but also for things we call psychological dependence. That means alcohol, absolutely. Heroin, of course. Amphetamines, very directly, as we'll see in a moment. Nicotine, yes. Caffeine, absolutely. All impact this addiction pathway. In addiction to the action of dopamine on this pathway, we also want you to understand that serotonin plays a role in addiction as well. Serotonin, you may recall from our previous conversation, has a role in a wide range of behaviors, but we want you to think about it mostly as involved in impulse control. Addiction is, at least in part, another impulse that you're unable to control. So it's lower serotonin levels that seem to be associated with more addictive behavior. The first substance we should talk about is alcohol. Why? Because alcohol is the most costly health problem in the United States. It costs us about $100 billion a year, a remarkably high figure, and that figure is only increasing. It is considered our most costly health problem. Obesity does, if you add up the figures, cost us a lot, but alcohol seems to cost us more. Now, I did not say alcohol accounts for the most loss of life. That honor, if it's an honor, goes to tobacco. Tobacco-related products, smoking, seems to kill more people than alcohol. But again, alcohol is still the most costly problem. If an exam question asks me, what's the best way to reduce long-term mortality in the United States, what will you do? Get people to stop drinking or get people to stop smoking? Well, getting people to stop smoking would have a bigger impact on long-term mortality. However, reducing cost should focus on alcohol issues. Let's talk about the alcohol facts. The most important alcohol fact is the first one. Alcohol is the most abused drug for any age, period. no matter what they give you, no matter what personal quality, no matter what age on an exam question, most abused drug is alcohol. A 15-year-old boy, renowned in his community for his work building model ships and airplanes. He has the largest collection of airplane glue of any child in the five state areas. He's also found to be a substance abuser. What substance is he most likely abusing? Answer, alcohol. All the rest of that stuff about the airplane glue is just smoke and mirrors. That's called a bait and switch question. We tell you a lot of content that doesn't matter and then slip a question in that you have to answer. Don't be fooled when they give you irrelevant information. A 65-year-old psychiatrist, famous for his work with anxiety disorders, is found on examining medical records to have prescribed more benzodiazepines in the last year than any physician in the entire country. He's also discovered to have been a substance abuser. What substance is he most likely abusing? Well, as I almost slipped and said, alcohol. It's always going to be alcohol, alcohol, alcohol. Now we're talking about abused drug. If you want to know what is the most used drug in the United States, what has most common usage, the answer there almost clearly is caffeine. But even though caffeine consumption is high, we don't usually talk about it as abuse. About one out of every 10 adults in the United States is a problem drinker. That term problem drinker actually incorporates two different ideas. One, people that are alcoholics, that is alcohol addicts. And two, people that are alcohol dependent. That is people that may not have the physical requirement to drink, but have the psychological impulse to drink that is uncontrollable. Male to female ratio is about 4-3. Used to be 2-1, but the gap is closing and continues to close. Once again, you've come a long way, baby. Now, since the 1980s, the per capita, that is the amount of alcohol consumed per person in the United States, has actually declined. That doesn't mean we're out of the woods. See, the proportion of people that are heavy drinkers under age 20 has increased, and binge drinking, especially on college campuses and just after college, is on the increase. Drinking patterns are shifting. Number of groups don't drink consistently, but they simply drink a lot at segmented periods of time. You should know that alcoholism rates are higher for low SES groups and therefore lower for high SES groups. People in the lower socioeconomic stratum are more likely to have alcohol problems. Since we're talking about SES, let's try this one. Who recovers sooner from alcoholism? People that are high SES or people that are low SES? Answer, based on the very excellent work of the Harvard psychiatrist George Valiant, is that low SES people recover sooner. If they don't die, then they recover sooner. Why? Well, there's a simple principle here. Alcoholics recover when? When they hit bottom. And who hits bottom sooner, high SES or low SES? Well, since low SES have less far to fall, they hit bottom sooner. They tend to have more recovery or recover sooner. Alcohol has been implicated in about 15% of all auto accidents. But once we kick off that first point, now we have the 50% rule from there down. 50% of all auto accidents not involving a pedestrian, alcohol related. 50% of all auto accident deaths, alcohol related. 50% of all homicides, alcohol related. 50% of all hospital admissions, alcohol related. If you recall when we were discussing alcohol hospital admissions earlier, we talked about psychiatric issues, that's alcohol. We also talked about GI problems, also an alcohol related issue. Let's talk about fetal alcohol syndrome. By data over the last 10 years, fetal alcohol syndrome is now the leading known cause of mental retardation. The leading cause of mental retardation, of course, cause unknown. But if we have a known cause, it's fetal alcohol syndrome. Downs is number two, not number one. How do you recognize fetal alcohol syndrome? Well, there's developmental mental retardation. There's also strange craniofacial abnormalities that are hard to describe, a sort of asymmetry as you look to the right and left side of the face, and limb dislocation, often shoulder, is very common as well. There is some recent research suggesting that although fetal alcohol syndrome is the leading known cause, that it requires relatively large quantities of alcohol to be consumed during pregnancy for the symptoms to appear. Just having a drink here or there doesn't seem, by any research, to be connected to fetal alcohol syndrome. Nonetheless, we do not want you to tell pregnant women it's okay to drink occasionally. We want you to err on the side of extra caution, which is pregnant women should not drink so as to reduce the chance of fetal alcohol syndrome to zero. We have increasing evidence over time that there is a genetic substrate for alcoholism. Let's review what this evidence is. Now, this is basically a series of theories, but the evidence is accumulating to support the theories. Here's the evidence. One, we have much higher concordance rates for monozygotic twins than dizygotic twins. Always our first-line evidence that there's a genetic substrate. Two, we find marked ethnic group differences in rates of alcoholism. Chinese, Jewish, Italian Americans have much lower rates of alcoholism than do Eastern Europeans, Irish Americans, Native Americans, for example. What's the issue here? Well, the issue seems to be what the culture does with alcohol. Every culture seems to feature alcohol in some capacity. The question is how people handle it in their day-to-day lives. Cultures where people drink to drink are more likely to produce alcoholics than cultures where people drink with food or as part of a religious ritual. You know what I mean? You come home from work, slap the vodka bottle on the table, start tossing back shots, more likely to produce alcoholic. You stop on the way home from work and have a couple pints with your mates at the pub, more likely to produce alcoholic than people that drink with food or as part of some other kind of occasion. The issue here is simple. You're getting a larger dose. When you have alcohol with food, the dose is buffered. When you just drink right out, then drinking gives you a larger dose of alcohol concentrated. Over time, what we think happens in these cultures is simple. One, you have simple Darwinian selection. People in cultures where people drink a lot survive and thrive if they can tolerate drinking a lot. Secondly, you have a behavior pattern in place. The behavior pattern is one where people drink a lot, and so the exposure to alcohol is higher for that culture than for other cultures. You want a simple prediction of who's more likely to have an alcohol problem? Look at their capacity to tolerate alcohol. We believe this is the underlying mechanism. People that can drink a lot and not appear to be drunk, these are people that are more susceptible to alcoholism. If I just say the word beer and you feel drunk, that means you're less likely to become an alcoholic. And one more piece of evidence. Here's an interesting study done where we took boys, all of whom were sired by biologically alcoholic fathers, half of whom were raised by biologically alcoholic fathers, and half of whom were raised by non-biologically alcoholic fathers. And then we looked at the rates of alcoholism in those boys as adults. You know what we found? We found that the rates were the same, telling us which seems to have more impact on the propensity for alcoholism. Is it nature or nurture? Well, it seems to be nature. It seems to be this genetic predisposition. What is that genetic predisposition? Easy, capacity to tolerate alcohol.